For the next segment of this journal club, Drs. Miller and Lynch tackled lung cancer. And to begin, I asked both faculty members to present patients from their practices that typify the bold new world of EGFR mutations and EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibition. Dr. Miller began by presenting a 50-year-old woman.
This is a lady I saw who was a never-smoker Russian woman who presented with cough. She had been seen locally in Brooklyn and diagnosed with stage 3B non-small cell lung cancer adenocarcinoma, a wet 3B, and she had no obvious metastatic disease. I think because of, in part, her preference and fears about chemotherapy, she was just started on a non-platinum doublet, and this was back in 2003 or so. And she was begun on gemcitabine and vinorelbine, which, you know, among non-platinum doublets is pretty well established and is pretty well tolerated. And she responded initially to therapy, but developed some bothersome fluid retention, a clot in upper extremity requiring anticoagulation. And after an 8-month progression-free period, she then progressed and came to see us. At that time, I had a trial open that's, you know, since been published in the JCO with erlotinib in patients with adenocarcinoma with BAC features or pure BAC. And when we reviewed her cytologic diagnostic specimen, she was eligible for the study from that perspective, and she had a profound response. Her disease essentially disappeared. And after we learned about the significance of EGF receptor mutations, we went back and tested her tumor, which was written into the consent form that we would be able to look for signatures of response, and found that she did indeed have an EGFR exon 21 point mutation. I see this lady every 1 to 2 months as per protocol, and she's now been on for 63 months without disease progression. It's been well tolerated. A number of the toxicities seem to attenuate over time.
Let me just ask Tom, you know, if a woman like this presented today in this situation, even before she got chemo, are we at a point now where really to do effective state-of-the-art care, her tumor, if possible, should be tested for mutations in KRAS?
Yes, and that's what my case will be, and that's what the most important paper I'll be discussing will address that as well. But I agree, and I think if this person presented to Vince today, Vince would have definitely tested the person up front.
Although, Vince, I mean, that's just not happening right now in clinical practice.
Well, I think we are at a watershed point in therapy of lung cancer, and we need to get the culture changed that we need more tissue for diagnosis, we need to do more with the lesser amounts of tissue we commonly have, and that it is important to have these answers. And Tom has the pleasure of discussing the data from the IPASS study, which really shows, even in an Asian population, that ethnicity, smoking history, gender, pathology are all trumped by molecular biology of lung cancer.
Okay, so let's get your case out on the table, Tom. But before you do, I just want to let both of you know that I've just sent a piece to print, which is the editor's note for our latest Patterns of Care study. Vince, you helped us execute the study. The title is Lung Cancer the New Breast Cancer? And in it, I make the argument that, you know, breast cancer, you use ER, HER2, it's a subset-driven strategy that is here for lung cancer. Do you agree, Tom?
I definitely agree. And I think that this case, I'm going to tell you about it, as well as the case that Vince presented, is a great example of that. That similar to the way that breast physicians are breaking down cases according to whether they're triple negative or whether they're HER2 positive or ER or PR positive, I think we'll be doing hopefully more and more of this in lung.
So Tom, let's hear about your case.
So my patient is a 43-year-old guy who lives in a suburb of Boston, never smoked cigarettes, and presented to his internist with some malaise, fatigue, and cough. The workup at that point revealed a large mass in his right upper lobe, 2 lesions in the liver, and a screening brain MRI revealed that he had 7 lesions in the brain, the largest being about 1 centimeter in size. He was feeling reasonably well, so we were able to obtain through a transthoracic core biopsy of the large right upper lobe mass a specimen which we sent prospectively for mutation testing. He was RAS mutation wild type, so he was wild type for RAS, and he had an exon 19 deletion in EGFR. He was a never smoker. Never smoking man. At that point, he was placed on erlotinib and had a beautiful response to erlotinib with a near complete resolution of the disease in his lung. During the time we were waiting for the testing to come back, he received whole brain radiation for his 7 brain metastasis. So he received whole brain to control the disease in his brain.
Just out of curiosity, would you consider in a situation like this, if you knew the patient had a mutation and was KRAS wild, trying erlotinib and maybe holding off on the radiation to the brain?
I absolutely would, and I was curious what Vince thinks about that as well. The sequence of when I saw the patient was after the whole brain had been instituted, but in this setting, I think that one, if you could get the information quickly enough, I absolutely believe that starting with erlotinib and following the CNS very carefully with a scan and MRI every month or so for the first couple of months to ensure response makes a lot of sense. Neil, I happen to be very worried about the long-term complications of CNS radiotherapy in a population of patients who are going to live a long time. I mean, these patients, as evidenced by Vince's case, she's lived already 63 months on TKI. And, you know, when we used to give 30 gray and 10 fractions for brain mets, we are doing it in a group of patients that were going to live 4 months to 8 months, not 64 months. So I absolutely think we should be more reserved in our use of whole brain radiotherapy in this particular setting.
So Vince, there's a lot of interest in the TKI lapatinib in breast cancer and the brain. What do we know about EGFR TKIs in non-small cell, specifically mutation patients, in terms of our objective responses seen in the brain?
Oh, absolutely. So I think I would approach Tom's patient in 2009 the same way he said he would in 2009, i.e., I would initiate the TKI. I'd be quite confident the brain lesions would improve if the systemic disease were going to improve, and I'd scan the patient initially after a month or so to make sure we were on the right track, and then after that I would be as concerned, but not more concerned, about the brain as the rest of the body.
So where is this man right now, Tom?
So interestingly, from a research standpoint, we drew a sample of his blood and analyzed it for circulating tumor cells at the time of diagnosis, and our analysis confirmed that there was an exon 19 deletion in the circulating tumor cells. Unfortunately, it also showed a very low-level T790M peak in his circulating tumor cells, which we didn't really know much of what to do with. As I mentioned, had a smashing response.
And we're going to talk about that, but basically that's what, a predictor of resistance?
So the T790M being a predictor of resistance, and it probably accounts for almost 40 to 50% of clinical resistance, the secondary mutation, at least in the work that Vince's group and our group and the Farber group has done looking at resistance patterns.
And we're going to talk about one of the papers that was reported on that.
Yes. And so interestingly, about 8 months into his treatment, his brain remained under superb control, lung remained under superb control as well, and he was found to have a progressively growing liver metastasis, one liver metastasis that's now 4 centimeters in size. It had nearly gone away with treatment. And so now I'm confronted with the problem of how to handle someone who's still having a beautiful CNS and lung response and yet has this one area of focal progression in the liver.
So why don't we throw it over to your colleague? You can refer the patient to Dr. Miller. Any thoughts about what he might do?
Well, I think this brings up the broader question, and I know you love on your presentations, Neil, that you hear what we would do, not what the papers say. And I'd be curious how Tom approaches this cadre of patients, but we see patients who have progression, who presented with stage 4 disease, who do incredibly well, and then 2 or 3 years later, they develop progression of disease in one site. And after, you know, meticulous evaluation, I would consider, if this lesion were amenable to some sort of local procedure, doing such, be it RFA. Certainly we've wedged out, you know, a growing lung nodule in the context of globally stable disease, a growing brain lesion in the context of stable disease, et cetera, et cetera. And I think this is part of the new standard or approach to a very select subset of stage 4 adenocarcinoma of the lung patients.
And I'll just interject, gentlemen, that we're doing a project along with Peter Ravden to put a fourth tab on adjuvant. Now it's got lung, colon, and breast. There's now going to be one called MET-RESECT to specifically provide information about the issue of it's going to start out with colon and liver mets, but eventually we'd like to see it address, you know, cases like this. What about the issue of systemic therapy, though, Vince? Suppose the patient, you know, has other sites of progression, for example.
Well, I think what we try to do in 2009 is, and we're actually debating amongst ourselves whether this is now our SOP or still needs to be done under the auspices of a protocol, we try to rebiopsy the patient, and we've successfully rebiopsied or gotten tissue of some sort on more than 100 patients. And we then try to define the mechanism of what we call acquired resistance in that patient, which I think we're going to talk about a little bit more later, and then at least make some attempt to see whether there's a clinical trial geared to that mechanism or whether one adjusts the treatment sort of empirically by adding in chemotherapy of some sort.
So we'll start to go through these papers in a second, but just to finish this out clinically, Tom, what did you do? What are you going to do?
So what we're doing right now is we are evaluating this for a potential second biopsy. My concern here is that the T790M that was present in low levels at the beginning is highly likely to be the mechanism here. And I would like to do one of two things, either put this patient on a protocol looking at one of the dual kinase inhibitors, and there's a number made by a number of different companies. There's one from Boehringer Ingelheim. There's a second from Pfizer that we're looking at. There's a third from Exelixis to look at one of the dual kinase inhibitors in this setting. And I think what's important about that is that I still think you need to have a tyrosine kinase inhibitor on board. If for whatever reason the patient doesn't qualify for that protocol, I would then consider giving chemotherapy and continuing the erlotinib at this point. Because I think the one thing I've learned from listening to Vince and to Mark and the folks at Memorial, I have come around on this point that you really have a situation where I really believe that the tyrosine kinase inhibitor he's taking is helping his brain and is helping the disease in his lung. And I believe in that setting that you want to keep a TKI going. Now, if you go to one of the dual kinase inhibitors, such as BIBW or Exelixis or the Pfizer compound, you still retain that activity against the exon 19 deletion. So I'm not as worried about it in that setting. But if I do move to chemotherapy for him, I think that you really want to be able to still keep that TKI activity. Vince, what are your thoughts about that?
Oh, thanks so much for bringing that up, Tom, because I think for guys in the community, this is really an important issue to be aware of, because even more often than with our practices, they can't get patients on protocols for a variety of reasons. We really believe that these patients are oncogene addicted for life and need to remain on an EGFR TKI or a dual inhibitor of some sort, just as you'd maintain androgen deprivation for life in HRPC. And again, absent a trial, we would continue erlotinib, say, and add in some sort of chemotherapy. And I think Tom, you know, has a good clue, as he alluded to in this particular patient, the mechanism of resistance, and therefore some insights on how to treat this rather than just empirically choosing chemotherapy.
I just want to make a brief comment and not spend a lot of time on the fact that, you know, I'm thinking it's like time to sort of wake up a little bit here. I mean, we know that these tests are not getting done on most patients in, you know, for example, the United States. And you listen to people like you in terms of how you manage. Of course, it's not most patients, but it's not a rare patient. And I mean, it seems to me it's time to start getting moving.
I agree entirely, Neil, and you've been an advocate for this for several years now, and I think you're right.
I'm a little bit concerned that it's not maybe happening fast enough, or maybe I'm impatient, but maybe this program can be part of changing it. One final question before we start going through these papers. I just want you to take a minute or two and tell me a little bit about the human implications of what happened to your two patients. Vince?
I think that when many of our educated Manhattanites walk through the door, they've been online, they've been reading a variety of things, which oftentimes are, you know, even a year or two outdated. And maybe a decade ago, that didn't make a big difference, but now it does. And I think the number one thing we do is tell the patient, say, if someone has tissue but hasn't been tested, we can take a little extra time, just like you would for any big investment, do the right research, get the right information, and get you the best possible treatment we can. And it's possible that your tumor may be successfully treated with a pill, and that if that is the case, you could do incredibly well. And if it's not, we will have you on the best possible chemo. We'll have insights into what's driving your tumor for the full natural history of it.
And Neil, I would say, if you think back to when you were in practice, in the beginning time of your practice, when you'd have somebody who came in with metastatic lung cancer, because I know I used to feel this way 20 years ago, you would root for them to have small cell and not non-small cell. And now the impact of the patient is very similar. When you have a never smoker who comes in, you're rooting for them to have a mutation the same way you used to root for them to have small cell. Because you knew when they had small cell, you had a number of different choices and it helped you down that paradigm. Now with EGFR, tyrosine kinase inhibitors, you're rooting for them to have a disease where you, at least we have some insight into the molecular biology behind it. And I think the patient really does invest themselves in that whole process. And then from the doctor's perspective, managing the disappointment of finding out their wild type for EGFR, I find to be one of the biggest challenges I have, because Vince's point about these patients being educated and being thoughtful is correct, and they know what the stakes are at this point.
Yeah, it's strange because in breast cancer now, a complete contrast to 3-4 years ago, people root for the patients to be HER2 positive.
Correct. You know,
there's an adverse prognostic feature. Now there are all these new exciting TDM1, et cetera, coming along. Vince, can you talk a little bit, just for a minute, about this woman, what her life was like when you first met her, and kind of what the impact of this has been in terms of, you know, her quality of life?
Well, I think that's one of the points, both physically and emotionally. I think the first thing we did was remove some fear from her.
What was her state of mind when you first met her?
Well, she was pretty ravaged because she was a very attractive, well-dressed person who'd had a lot of morbidity, nothing intractable from chemotherapy, and was frustrated by it. She had a lot of fluid retention, and she told the chemo, which had initially worked, it stopped working, and that was only an 8-month period, which, while by our literature and everything, you know, that would have been okay some time ago, was very disappointing, especially when you're at month 8 of the 8-month stay of execution. So I think the first thing to do was to reassure her that we have options. There's a good chance you will respond to this pill. We didn't know about mutations when she first began the study. And I think she became comfortable and then excited after seeing her CAT scan results, both with the receding of the toxicities of chemo, but also hearing that her cancer had been, again, controlled.
What's her lifestyle like? What does she do? What does she enjoy?
Oh, her lifestyle's quite good. I mean, she works, had worked, quit her job. She travels quite a bit. Each time she dresses like $1 million, she's a very positive person, and I think we've been able to maintain that and re-energize that as compared to when she first presented to see us.
Has she kind of gotten up to speed about mutations and all this other stuff, or has he left that up to you?
This particular lady sort of leaves it in my hands, although certainly we have a whole cadre of patients, as I'm sure Tom does, who know as much or more than he or I might in certain situations.
Tom, what about your patient? What was his situation? What was his state of mind when you first met him?
So he was a young, relatively, as I mentioned, 43-year-old guy, young family, and was obviously, as I said, very invested in knowing about the mutation status. But we did share with him the issue of the T790M being present. So I think that he was appropriately cognizant that this could come back. The thing that I've found with these patients that's remarkable is that the speed of response, it's like treating lymphoma. Their pain goes away, their fatigue gets better, and it really is a dramatic improvement in how they feel fundamentally.
Did he have tumor-related symptoms when he started treatment?
He presented with fatigue, tiredness, and some shortness of breath, but mostly sort of nonspecific type symptoms, which all got better when his disease started to improve.
What's his sort of state of mind? How is he dealing with the issue of his family? Does he have younger children?
Has young kids, relatively young kids, 14 and 11. I think that the issue really is managing the news around the progression. He had invested so much into the concept of the molecular targeted therapy working the first time around, and then to have an only 8-month benefit is obviously devastating. And so the question then is trying to manage the expectations of the next treatment. And I actually find that obviously challenging as well. And, you know, he's appropriately upbeat. I think that one thing that Vince and I can probably agree upon is that people who seek you out for this type of care are people who are very much invested in doing the best they can and learning the most that they can about that. People who participate in clinical trials, I think, are special in that respect. But obviously, the 8-month progression-free survival was less than either he or I wanted to see in that circumstance.
Okay, one more question back to you, Vince, which is, you know, sort of this new biology, the new subset approach to lung cancer. We talked about EGFR mutations. We'll talk about that a lot more. But just bottom line in terms of KRAS, what do we know about KRAS and either EGFR antibodies or TKIs in lung cancer?
The first point is that KRAS mutations, although having a loose correlation with the tobacco history, are not rare in never smokers. And that's one of the things that argues for the non-empiric approach to therapy. That in work that Greg Riley from our hospital presented at ASCO, the frequency of KRAS mutations in never smokers with adenocarcinoma is about 15%.
And actually, Greg was on our series. And do you believe that there's adequate data to say that if a patient has a KRAS mutation, they're not going to respond to an EGFR TKI?
Well, you made it easy on me because you asked about response. And yeah, I think there is a pooled literature that the response rate is 1%, you know, plus or minus 0.5% to EGFR TKIs. One can argue about, you know, whether RAS mutations are predictive and prognostic and whether these patients do less well with chemo, et cetera, but certainly I'm hard-pressed to use an EGFR TKI in such a patient.
Agree or disagree, Tom?
I agree entirely with Vince on that. I think this identifies patients who don't benefit. In fact, many of the trials now of second and third generation therapy with EGFR TKIs are being done in patients who are RAS wild type just because of that.
Okay, so I want to go through these six papers very briefly. We'll start out with you, Vince, with a paper in our favorite journal, Journal of Molecular Diagnostics. Actually, you're a co-author on it from your group, looking at EGFR mutations and lung adenocarcinomas.
So this paper really put to print our initial experience clinically with rolling out diagnostic testing. And these are patients essentially with adenocarcinoma whose specimens were received in DMP, diagnostic molecular pathology, over a 12-month period. So we did 300 cases in a 12-month period. And this speaks to one of your earlier comments. At that time, this was more than a company that did this testing had done in a year. So I think the clinicians had all bought into it, including the surgeons and even some pulmonologists. And the results we found were consistent with that in the published literature, with the bias, of course, that we would be inclined to sequence patients who maybe had more modest smoking histories. Now, of course, we reflexively do all the patients in whom we have tissue. And we found the mutations in exon 19 and exon 21 in about 70% and 30% respectively. Our tests at this time only look for those two mutations. So there are about 10% of patients who have a different EGFR mutation which are not detected by these two specific assays. And we can talk a little bit about those mutations. Some of them are known to be associated with sensitivity, some are known to be associated with resistance, and many have uncertain significance or response information as to the use of EGFR TKIs. The other thing we did in this test, in this study, was to compare, was to look for the frequency of EGFR amplification by a technique called SISH, which is quite similar to FISH, and to look for EGFR expression. And I think one of the big challenges for docs in the community who are looking at lymphoma data, leukemia data, breast data, and now lung comes up with some of these things, is to keep straight, you know, what does IHC predict and what is IHC? What does FISH predict and what is FISH? What do mutations predict and how is that testing done? What are the false positives, negatives, and caveats? And in our hands, you know, we did find EGFR amplification more commonly in EGFR mutated tumors. So more than half of the tumors for which we looked for EGFR amplification with mutation had it, while it was rare in non-mutated tumors. And we saw little correlation for EGFR, IHC with any of the variables looked at in this analysis. And so I think for TKIs, the data that one should be testing for EGFR, quote, expression, unquote, meaning immunohistochemistry, is largely absent. And it may be different for the antibodies, as we'll probably talk about later. So those would be my comments.
Tom, any thoughts about this paper?
I think the take-home message I get from this paper is the idea that about half your mutation-positive patients also are amplified. And I think we've seen that now in several papers from the group at Memorial, as well as our group and the groups in Japan have shown that as well. I think that's a very important contribution.
What about the issue of how much tissue is needed to do, for example, KRAS and mutation studies, and how many patients do not usually have adequate amount of tissue?
So, Neil, that's a terrific question, and it's changing, as Vince alluded to. We are getting better at doing this with smaller and smaller pieces of tissue. We, in general, like a core biopsy to be able to get adequate tissue and feel comfortable. I have occasionally gotten mutation detection on aspirates, on fine needle aspirates of the lung, but we certainly feel more comfortable with core biopsies. And so a core biopsy is usually adequate to get your answer and to be able to detect mutations.
Where do you think right now, today, is the best place to send tissue? Vince? I mean, if it were you or if it were, you know, whatever, you know, where is the best place to send tissue?
Well, at our hospital, I don't know how Tom handles this, but we don't do outside specimens unless the patient's also been seen for a consultation. But of course, Genzyme does do specimens that can be mailed out. And I think their turnaround, if it's within, you know, 2 weeks, is reasonable in almost all clinical scenarios.
There's a lot of discussion. We had a whole day-long roundtable on breast cancer about this, about quality control and assays. Big controversy with HER2 and ER. What do we know about quality control with mutation and KRAS testing?
Well, I think that there's some good reviews on this. I think that one has to be aware of the limitations of a given test. For example, some tests can be incredibly sensitive, but will only find mutations for which they are engineered to look for. Other tests are less sensitive. For example, the Genzyme assays do direct sequencing, but I've had a number of patients come in with reports for mutations that we would not routinely detect, for which the clinical implications may be unclear. So, for example, insertion mutations in exon 19 or insertion mutations in exon 20 other than the known gatekeeper mutation.
Tom, what about mutation frequency in smokers?
So obviously we see far lower rates of mutations in smokers, probably in the 1% range. Interesting, I was in a meeting with Dr. Mitsudomi from Japan, who probably has the largest experience with testing in large populations. And he actually believes, and Vince, curious what you think about this, he believes that the rate of developing an EGFR mutated lung cancer is similar in smokers or non-smokers. But in smokers, they also get tobacco associated lung cancers at such a high frequency that it dilutes out the EGFR mutated cancers. And so they, in Japan, will have a lower threshold for testing smokers than we would in North America. What are your thoughts about that, Vince?
Well, we do test, you know, any adenocarcinoma. We've certainly found EGF receptor mutations in patients with 50, 60, 70 pack year smoking histories. I think the challenge in those patients, and what some of our data and probably others have shown, is that those patients do not do as well with the EGFR TKI. Although they have a high response rate, the duration of response appears shorter. And of course, that's likely, you know, due to a variety of the other lesions commonly seen in lung cancer.
Let's try to get through your other two papers, Vince. One with a number of many studies that are out there, including many from your group, including this one, looking at the issue of acquired resistance to EGFR TKIs and, you know, from my view, kind of the biology of what you're finding.
So I think the first point is that when you and I and Tom spoke about continuing patients on an EGFR TKI at the time of progression, we're talking about a very select subset of patients. We're not talking about the patient who went on an EGFR TKI for 2 months, had a CAT scan that was stable, and a month later progressed. No, we're talking about the patient in whom this, to some extent, really appeared to be the Achilles heel of their tumor. And, for example, the individuals described in Tom's case and my case are, you know, classic patients in whom we'd sort of define acquired resistance. And in those patients, you know, our initial work in Boston really borrowed from the analogies we've seen in CML and GIST tumors, that oftentimes when these patients progress, their tumor has acquired a second mutation that either prevents binding of the TKI contacting the right residues in the ATB binding pocket, or changes the affinity of the TKI versus that of ATP. There's some debate about which of these is the more important or dominant mechanism. The most common mechanism of acquired resistance is what Tom described earlier, this T790M, which probably accounts for 40 to 50% of cases we see. And this in select centers can be detected in the bloodstream, as Tom described, with CTCs. In other places can be detected by rebiopsying the individual. I'd be curious, since Tom may be a little bit ahead of us in the sensitivity of some of the tests with which he works, how often he thinks T790M is actually present at baseline. And part two is, does he think it's present at baseline in everyone, but it's just in some small subset of tumor cells that we don't find it?
I think that's a great question. I think it depends upon the sensitivity of the assay that you're looking at, but with these newly highly sensitive Scorpion Arms assays that they're doing now, we think it may be present in as many as 50-60% of people at baseline. if you look carefully enough. It's not entirely clear if that's true, but that's what our initial thoughts may be, that it may be that many. And I think that that probably helps define the two types of populations of patients we see with mutations in terms of response. There's the one type that is very similar to the patient that Vince provided, and the initial patient that led to us finding mutations in MGH is still disease-free and going well 70 months into therapy. And I know, doesn't Mark Criss have somebody who's even longer than that? So those people, I think, probably did not have T790M ever in their specimen. And then this other group of patients who have progression-free survivals that are closer to 8 to 10 months, I think those patients, many of them, I think, will end up having T790M as their predominant mechanism of resistance. And it may be that the second novel mutation that you're describing will also be similar to that.
So in this paper here from November in Clinical Cancer Research, you were describing another mutation?
Yeah, so we and others have reported other mutations associated with acquired resistance. And this mutation, T855-4A, appeared to impart a relative resistance to erlotinib and gefitinib, but not the sort of absolute resistance one would see with T790M. The cells we transfected with the mutation then treated with the TKI were about threefold more resistant to erlotinib or gefitinib than parental cells without the T854A.
How about your paper, Vince, in the JCO looking at bronchial alveolar carcinoma molecular characteristics?
Well, I think that this was a trial that we began actually in 2002 when we had first started using these drugs, and Tom and I and others were making observations, gee, patients with this clinical feature or that clinical feature seem to benefit the most. And one of the groups that stood out was the never smoking female with adenocarcinoma or BAC. And so this is a group in this particular trial who was well annotated for their pathologic subtype. They had to first agree to have their pathology reviewed to see if they were eligibility. So it was a two-part consent process. And if they were and otherwise met eligibility, they could be treated. So within this study of approximately 100 patients, we had tissue for at least one of the relevant markers, EGFR and KRAS mutations, we prioritized first. And of course, doing any study where tissue is limited, you have to prioritize which test you'll do. So mutation first, then we looked at amplification, and then we looked at IHC. But clearly in our hands, the mutation was the best predictor of response, and granted it's a 100-patient study, so the p-values aren't going to be spectacular, but the trends were clearly also correlated with survival. There may be an additive effect of amplification to mutation in this trial, at least that's suggested, but I think the other point, of course, is that the patients with KRAS mutations did not respond to erlotinib.
Tom, anything you want to say about this paper?
No, I think it's a great contribution to the literature that helps us sort out this issue. And I think that similar to this, the work that Vince and others at Memorial have done, looking at the fact that it appears to be the adenocarcinomas with BAC features that are the ones that are going to be EGFR mutated and be the ones who are the responders, as opposed to the pure mucinous BACs that may well have RAS mutations. I think finding the molecular correlates to that is really terrific.
Tom brought up something real important, again, for the guys in the community. If you see a never smoker with mucinous BAC, do not think Tarceva. There's an incredibly high chance this individual has a KRAS mutation. There's papers from Harvard and elsewhere that mucinous BAC has a 70 or 80% chance of harboring a KRAS mutation.
So would you send a KRAS study?
I personally would, because we have it at hand and I'd like to know, and obviously there's a percentage who don't have the mutation. But absent that, if you have a paucity of tissue or a pathology report from 3 years ago and you don't know where the tissue is, I would avoid Tarceva.
Well, I think the good news is with our colleagues, and we'll hear from our gastrointestinal oncology colleagues soon, with the quality of RAS mutation work going up around the country now and all the different pathology sections, I'm probably more inclined to recommend it than I would have a couple of years ago.
What about the quality of histopathology readings from pathologists in terms of, you know, differentiating these various subtypes? Vince?
Well, mucin is easy, I've been told by pathology. See mucin, that jumps out of you. So that should be something the clinician should think to ask about or should go off as a buzzword. Certainly, looking at the most common adenocarcinoma is one which has multiple subtypes therein. And whether each of those subtypes contributes something different on a molecular basis or whether there's something else that determines how they look under the microscope that doesn't really drive their virulence is unclear. And one of the most challenging areas, for example, is papillary and bronchoalveolar cancer. papillary subtype and bronchoalveolar. I've had Bill Travis tell me he went to Japan and was shocked at what they were calling one and what he was calling the other. So no, that's not going to be readily distinguished with a high inter-observer concordance.
So Tom, let's go through your papers, beginning with the IPASS study.
So I can tell you that I'm sure Vince was quite jealous when he saw that I got the IPASS study to discuss, because I think among thoracic oncologists, this is by far the most interesting and important study in the past several years. And what this study did was it was done in a group of patients in Asia who were light or never smokers. And in the end, the population was 94% never smokers, and it was approximately 80% women. So a high percentage of Asian women never smokers contributed to this trial. And what the study did is it randomized patients between gefitinib versus carboplatin and paclitaxel, looking at progression-free survival as the primary endpoint. And I would argue that for the practicing doctor that this is one of the first examples of where PFS is important in lung cancer, because many of these patients will get gefitinib second line or carboplatin second line, and they may respond to that. And it's more akin to the breast cancer population where PFS is now a very important endpoint. In the IPASS study, the primary endpoint was met with a superior PFS to gefitinib compared to chemotherapy. And overall survival results are still immature and are pending at this point. Response rate was higher to gefitinib than to chemotherapy, and quality of life and symptoms were better with gefitinib than with chemotherapy. But what's most important in this trial, and the biggest take-home message in this trial, is that when you looked at the population, and they had approximately a 60% mutation rate, when you looked at outcome based on EGFR mutations, positive or negative, that's where the whole story of this study is. So if you had an EGFR mutation, you had a dramatic benefit with gefitinib compared to chemotherapy. What's important, though, is if you did not have a mutation and you received gefitinib as your first-line therapy, you did not do well. You did poorly. And chemotherapy was definitely a better choice for you than gefitinib. So this has really changed my practice in two important ways. I've been giving mutation-positive patients a tyrosine kinase inhibitor first-line for many years. But I had also been giving never-smoking Japanese women tyrosine kinase inhibitors first-line. And what this tells me is those clinical criteria are just not good enough. You need molecular profiling to be able to determine that. And so if I don't have molecular profiling, either because the sample was too small or the test did not work, or I'm worried the patient isn't going to do well for the 3 or 4 weeks it takes to get the result back, I think you should lead with chemotherapy. And what they saw in this setting is the chemotherapy outcomes were actually pretty good in the mutation-positive patients as well. So they did okay, not as well as with gefitinib, but they did okay with chemotherapy. So I think that there's a lot of practice-changing implications of the IPASS study for this population of patients.
Vince?
Great study, validates that the biggest determinant is the molecular abnormality and not the surrogate clinical marker. And I'm jealous of whoever's getting to review this paper if it's been submitted yet.
So Vince, I talked to your guy, William Powell, one of your colleagues there at the big lung oncology center there, about the study he's doing on non-smokers. And he said, well, I'm trying to, you know, get the word out. And I said, well, hey, guess what? Vince is going to be on our show next week. And probably 2/3 of the oncologists in the United States are going to hear it. So I said, I'll ask him to give you an ad. So can you tell people about William's study and how they can participate?
Yeah, so we have borrowed from what was done in some of the original CML work from Gary Gilliland and others in Boston and Ross Levine, by creating a website and an associated trial. And the trial basically asked the individual who's a never smoker with no prior cancer to complete a questionnaire and to give a tube of blood with shipping instructions are provided and a FedEx number provided and so forth. And of course, there's no charge. The motivation for the study is to collect DNA from nearly 2,000 patients who are never smokers with lung cancer and controls and to look for SNPs or copy number variations that could be associated with this entity.
So the website is listed in the booklet with this program, but it's on the Memorial website under Never Smokers with Lung Cancer for those who are interested, and hopefully a lot of people will be.
Certainly we're a ways away from saying you need to have your children tested to look to see if they have this SNP that predisposes to lung cancer in never smokers. But that's the long-term vision.
Yeah, well, I've got to think that people are getting their blood drawn anyhow. I'd be happy to have some blood sent in so we could learn more about this disease. So, Tom, what do you think they're going to see in terms of the fraction of these non-smokers who have mutations and what kind of mutations?
Well, I think they'll find that if you enrich your population, you'll probably find 20-25% of your lung cancers will be EGFR mutated if you look at never smokers or non-smokers. In our prospective study of gefitinib in patients with EGFR mutations, we tested 100 patients and found 35 that had EGFR mutations. And we basically use smoking as the best predictor of what the mutation frequency is going to be. So depending upon how refined the population is, I think the chance of finding EGFR mutations will be somewhere in the 20-30% range.
When I was talking with William about this, I know they're looking, as you mentioned, at SNPs and all kinds of really interesting things. I think it's going to be a fantastic study.
Yeah.
So we've got a couple of papers that relate to cetuximab and non-small cell. First, Tom, the JCO paper by Hirsch et al.
So the first paper is Fred's paper that looked at EGFR gene copy numbers. You know, Neil, this year at ASCO, we learned that cetuximab can have a modest but real benefit in patients with non-small cell lung cancer. And it's really caused us to ask, well, what is the best way of selecting those patients? We're very envious of the colon guys that they have found RAS mutations to be able to segregate and sort out those patients who appear to benefit from cetuximab. I think in lung cancer, we need to get more clarity on which patients benefit.
I might say, too, that they and everybody else in oncology, amazingly enough, are envious of the lung guys now because of the EGFR mutations.
Mutations, right. So in this paper, Fred looked retrospectively at patients who entered the SWOG study, which looked at either sequential cetuximab chemo or concurrent cetuximab chemo. And what they found in a hypothesis-generating paper was that those patients who had a high FISH score did better with cetuximab and chemo than those patients with a low FISH score. And this tends to go against what you'd expect. You'd expect high FISH score patients to not do as well prognostically. So Fred raised the question of whether or not we may one day be able to use FISH to predict which patients might benefit from cetuximab chemotherapy. Now, we did learn some information at World Lung in Chicago that may call this into question, which was a molecular subtyping of the 099 study, which randomized people to carbotaxol or carbotaxol plus cetuximab. I was the first author of that study. And
that was the one you had presented previously, right?
One I had presented previously. And so then we presented the molecular correlates at Chicago this year.
And I guess the initial presentation was kind of lukewarm in terms of what you saw.
Initial presentation, basically it missed its primary endpoint, which is PFS. It hit response rate, and it had a survival benefit very similar to that which was seen in FLEX. However, it wasn't powered for that, and it was therefore not statistically significant. So it was a negative study. When one looked at RAS, when one looked at copy number by FISH for EGFR or IHC, we did not see that FISH panned out as being an important prognostic factor. Now, what we're waiting for is the analysis of the samples from the FLEX study, and that hopefully will be out next ASCO, so we'll have some important work there. So while Fred's study is certainly intriguing, the first randomized trial which looked at this hasn't necessarily supported it, and doesn't mean it's not an important endpoint, but it's just something which I think this may turn out to be more complex in terms of figuring out what works.
Vince, are there ongoing research efforts right now in a randomized or non-randomized fashion to determine the molecular predictors of response to cetuximab in non-small cell?
Well, I think the thoracic oncology world may have been caught a bit off guard when the initial signal from KRAS was not as powerful as we expected it might be. I personally am not convinced that we've seen enough data to impugn or not impugn KRAS as a predictor of benefit from cetuximab. Short of that, I think it brings up a number of questions regarding the mechanism of action of cetuximab in non-small cell lung cancer, why we didn't see activity with panitumumab and do see activity with cetuximab. And I'm not aware of a number of prospective trials being done with uniform tissue acquisition that are trying to elucidate the mechanism of action or predictors of benefit. Certainly one thing that we've asked folks to look at or that we think are important are look at the ligands, particularly the amphiregulin and epiregulin, which have had some predictive value in colorectal cancer as well. And I think that's something we should bring up when we to summarize with our colleagues in those diseases.
So, Tom, just to clarify, are there studies ongoing, for example, right now in the cooperative group mechanism, which are addressing cetuximab?
Yes. So the cooperative group study, the intergroup study that's currently before the regulatory agencies for approval, is a trial of carboplatin paclitaxel in all histologies with Bev, if you're Bev eligible, and then randomization cetuximab, no cetuximab, with enough tissue collection to answer the question of FISH and to look at RAS as well. So Vince's point that much of this is retrospective and much of it is based on small sample numbers is correct. And hopefully this SWOG study will have enough samples so that we'll be able to look at biologic determinants of outcome in that setting.
So just to clarify, this is Bev versus cetuximab?
Everybody gets Bev.
Oh, plus cetuximab.
Right. So what's interesting in looking ahead to the papers from the GI group, they've been barking up that tree before,
right,
and they haven't
right.
exactly been impressed by what they found.
Well, certainly the translational aspects of that study are going to be critical. Let's talk about the last paper, Tom, looking at another potential strategy in terms of combined biologic therapy, which would be cetuximab and an EGFR TKI, in this case, gefitinib.
So this paper is by Dr. Ramalingam working with Chandra Balani at Pittsburgh. And what this study really did was show that you can feasibly give what some people would call total EGFR blockade, give cetuximab along with gefitinib in patients with non-small cell lung cancer. It's a small trial published in the Journal of Thoracic Oncology and showed that if you gave cetuximab at 250 milligrams per meter squared weekly with gefitinib at 250 milligrams per day, one could do this, and one could give these drugs and not develop any untoward toxicity. It doesn't really make any significant comments or ability to make comments about activity in this setting because the number of patients obviously is quite small. But I think that this is a question that people feel is worth looking at as to whether or not total EGFR blockade may prove to have benefits. And I know that there are phase two trials that people are planning, or I think have actually begun in this setting.
And Vince, we're seeing in a lot of different tumors this concept of trying to look at combinations, vertical, horizontal targeting, whatever that is. And when I saw this paper, I was thinking, oh, yeah, that makes sense. I was kind of surprised that it hadn't been looked at before.
I agree with you. And I know that these studies were started quite some time ago, and they've been very slow to develop in terms of results.
We have a trial open with the combination, giving cetuximab in an every 2 week schedule and erlotinib 100 milligrams daily. It's a phase 1-2 study that Greg Riley and I lead, and we're excited to accrue patients to that. Off protocol, I can say anecdotally, we have had at least one genuine response adding cetuximab to erlotinib and acquired resistance. So I think the key thing would be to study this once one gets a dose and schedule in an enriched population of some sort with biomarker-driven corollaries.